The words we use for foods can reveal a deep cultural history. Dan Jurevsky, a professor of linguistics and computer science at Stanford University, joins us for this week's Please Explain segment to dig through some of that history. He's the author of The Language of Food, A Linguist Reads the Menu. It's published by Norton. Hello, welcome to our show.
Leonard, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we also, and by the way, congratulations on the Giants if you're a Giants fan.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, it was quite a festival in the city last night.
We invite our listeners to join the conversation. Give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org or also write to us on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Dan, you start your book by looking at ketchup. Where does the word ketchup come from?
Ketchup is a great story. So the you think about our national foods, you know, hamburgers and frankfurters and french fries, you know, the stuff we export to the world. And really the names of those foods remind us that we're an immigrant nation. You know, hamburgers come from Hamburg and frankfurters from Frankfurt and french fries are, you know, probably from Belgium, but close enough to France. And ketchup is the same thing. Ketchup actually is a Chinese word. And the way I like to tell the story is imagine that you're a sailor. It's the 17th century. You're an English sailor, English or Dutch sailor, sailing to China because China's where porcelain and silk and tea and spices come from. And what do you drink on these ships? You know, it's a long sea voyage. It's hot. You're crossing the equator. And you have wine and beer. You know, it's hard to find fresh water. You have wine and beer, but those go sour. You know, in those days, they didn't have hops in the beer yet, and the wine wasn't really properly preserved. So you have this kind of sour beer and sour wine, and they get to Indonesia and they find ethnic Chinese settled throughout Indonesia who are making local sauces. They're making soy sauce. They're making fish sauce, just like the modern Vietnamese fish sauce. And they're also distilling liquor. They're making this liquor called arak, which is an ancestor of rum. And distillation's been invented. The Chinese had invented it. The Arabs had invented it. And it had begun to creep into Europe, but it was still early, and gin hadn't been invented yet. And people didn't really know what this distilled spirits were. They called it this hot drink that the Chinese were making. And they were very excited because distilled liquor doesn't go bad in the heat. So they bought thousands of barrels. The British Navy bought thousands of barrels of this arak, and they used it to invent the world's first cocktail called punch. They added the lemons they were using to prevent scurvy, and they brought it home. And while they were there, they bought some barrels of this sauce that they were making called, in the local Chinese dialect, it was called gadzup, which means fish sauce. Jup means sauce. And in fact, jup still means sauce in modern Cantonese.
So it's really a fish sauce?
It was the original ketchup was exactly the same as modern Vietnamese fish sauce. And then what happened is they bring this fish sauce home to England, and it's really expensive, right? They're shipping it all the way across the world in bottles. They actually brought bottles to Indonesia and to Vietnam and to Hong Kong, filled them with fish sauce, bring them home. And it's expensive. And what do you do when you have an exotic, expensive imported product? You invent knockoffs. So immediately there's knockoff ketchups, and they're made out of mushrooms. They're made out of walnuts. Jane Austen's family had a walnut ketchup. And then around 1800, they start adding tomatoes. And these are all salty sauces, not like our modern ketchup. And then sometime around 1850, they kind of started dropping the fish out of the fish and tomato sauce. And Americans especially added a lot of sugar after the Civil War, and sugar became cheaper. And the result is our modern kind of chutney. And the whole history, this whole story of Europeans trading with Asia and the importance of China economically, it's all there in the name for this food that we use every day.
And it's interesting that they still put tomato ketchup on the labels of most bottles, as though there were other kinds of ketchups.
Exactly. I mean, this is a great linguistic clue. In fact, you know, language is logical. If we call something tomato ketchup, there's a reason for saying that. And of course, the reason is there were lots of other ketchups until quite recently. It wasn't until, you know, very recently, 1910, that all those, you know, walnut ketchups and mushroom ketchups died out.
And the word ketchup, that's Heinz's spelling of it, right? And
yeah,
you also see it sometimes catsup.
Absolutely. So there's another linguistic fun note there. You know, if you have a word like that that's borrowed from a language like Chinese, which doesn't use the Roman alphabet, you have all these early spellings that, you know, people heard this Chinese word and they just wrote it down however they could. And it wasn't just English people writing down, English-speaking people. The Dutch wrote it down and the Portuguese wrote it down. And so we have all these spellings from all these different languages. So, you know, my guess, we may never know, but my guess is that the catsup spelling might have been a Portuguese person writing it down, and the spelling with a K might have been a Dutch person writing it down. And there's actually early spelling C-A-T-C-H-U-P. So we have all this evidence that lots of different people were trying to, you know, transliterate this Chinese word. And then the spellings, the catsup with a C was kind of more common in the U.S. and with a K was more common in England. And then Heinz sort of liked the ketchup with a K as a way of distinguishing itself from the other American ketchups. And then Heinz, became the bestseller. And so that became the standard spelling.
Is there a lot of this kind of East-West merging in our food language?
There is. There's. It's fascinating. If you look at all sorts of words, they point to not necessarily just China, but the East in general. So lots of foods come from Persia or from the Middle East or from Arabic. So I don't know, words like sherbet or sorbet, you know, or syrup, come straight from the Arabic word for drink, or lots of fun examples like that, where things that we think of every day as a non-Asian or non-Middle Eastern food are, in fact, the name is still there reminding us.
And then there are Arabic words that work their way into our language through Spain.
Yes. So,
is mayonnaise an Arabic word?
Mayonnaise is named for Mayon, which is a place. Mm-hmm. So not that one. But pretty much, you know, all the words that start with AL are Arabic. So that's your alcohols and your algebras. And lots of the spice names came through Arabic. But also just basic fruit names. Lemon is an Arabic word. I already said sherbet. Syrup, sugar. We get sugar from Arabic, and coffee. You know, really, like, how could you live without these foods? Alcohol, sugar, and coffee. It's all Arabic.
Dan Jarofsky is a professor of linguistics and computer science at Stanford University. His book, The Language of Food, A Linguist Reads the Menu, is published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And we invite your calls if there are words, foods, names, or words in food that you've always been curious about. Well, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. Leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org or write to us on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. A few weeks ago, we talked to a couple of people from the New York Public Library about their menu collection, which is now available online. What have you learned from that collection?
That is a great collection, and we've done a couple studies on menus. One is a historical study looking at the New York Public Library's collection. One is a kind of snapshot in time of modern menus, and they tell us actually really interesting different things. I'll start with the modern menus. So we looked at 6,500 menus grabbed from the web across America. And we find really big differences in the language that they use depending on the price of the restaurant. So, for example, the cheaper the restaurant, the more likely the menu is to have the pronoun you on it. So they'll say your way or any way you like them or your choice. Whereas the more expensive the restaurant, the more likely it's going to be talking about the chef. You'll see words like chef's choice or chef selection. So it's like the expensive restaurants, really you're going to the theater. You're paying for someone else, the chef. It's really about what the chef is creating for you. The cheaper restaurants, it's your day-to-day choice, and they want to emphasize, you know, your role in these things.
What about the reliance on French or even French-sounding words on many American menus?
Yeah, this is a great one. So, if you look at the New York data, the historical data, so let's say 100 years ago, 1900, 1910, all fancy menus were in French. Even when you describe an Italian dish, you would describe it in French. French was the language of fancy food, and that persisted for a long time. So even in the 1960s, there's these great, you know, manuals for restaurateurs to explain how to write a menu, and they say, oh, you should continentalize your menu, by which they meant stick French in randomly. So there's these great examples like le crab meat cocktail. You just take the word le and stick it on things, and that was a way of indicating that you had aspirations of being a fancy restaurant.
What about
and that was
you, yeah, go ahead
finish
well
that seems to have died out. So that's that's just not anymore a way of marking high class. We have all these other methods now for marking status.
Well, I've always wondered about the French word entree, which means beginning. How did it become the main course?
Oh, that's one of my favorite stories. So, you know, I have these friends that I visit all the time from England or from France, and where the word entree there means the, what we call the appetizer. Mm-hmm. So in America, entree means the main course. In England and France, the entree means the appetizer. And since entree in French means entrance, they're sort of assuming that Americans kind of got it wrong somewhere. And it turns out that the American meaning is actually closer to the original meaning of the word. The word entree used to mean the entering meat course. So there might have been other things, a soup or a fish, but then the meat courses started entering, and the entree was the first of those. They called it a made dish. It might have been, you know, fried or braised or something, and then there'd be a roast afterwards. So there was a meat course called the entree, and then other meat courses like a roast. And slowly over time, we stopped eating these, you know, 8-course menus with the fish and then the soup and then the entree and then the roast. And we ended up with just 3 courses. And in American English, we kept that word entree to describe that kind of meaty main course. And the entree and the roast kind of fell together. Whereas in France, you see these dictionaries in the 1930s saying, oh, the French people, they're using the word entree wrong, because they were beginning to use the word entree to mean the appetizer, because to a French speaker, entrance is a natural word for an appetizer. But historically, that wasn't the meaning, and the dictionaries were complaining. People were writing letters to the editor saying, people are using the word entree to mean an appetizer. It's not an appetizer. So the American meaning is, in fact, the older one.
There were restaurants and inns way before there were menus. When did menus start being used?
Well, the word menu and the common concept of giving people a menu seems to have come roughly in the 18th century. So in the Middle Ages, people, and even quite later than the Middle Ages, food was served often all the food at once on the table. Maybe there'd be two coursings. You'd fill the table with different food, and then you'd take it all away and fill it all again. And the idea of instead moving to an ordered coursed menu seems to have arisen around the 17th or 18th century. And the menu was like a little card that diners would get by their plate listing the courses, so they knew what they were going to be eating next.
Why do we use the same word toast for something that we eat at breakfast and also when we raise our glass to someone? Are they linked?
They are linked. You know, a lot of times, you know, sometimes there are these coincidences, but this is a clear case the word originally meant grilled bread, and it happens that in the Middle Ages, people put grilled bread in their wine. They also put it in their soups. But they would take this grilled bread, you know, you make toast by the fire, and you would spice it. You spice it with ginger or galangal or these other really great medieval spices. And you'd put it in your wine, and wine was, you know, we think now of wine as something that you drink that should be clear, and soups are often like clear broths, and that just wasn't how people ate in the Middle Ages. You wanted to add some sustenance, you know, some thickness to your drinks, and so they'd have these spiced toast in wine, and Shakespeare talks about it. Falstaff used to love, you know, toast in his sack. And just as this concept was dying out, as people, you know, began to start drinking their wine more without the toast, right about the same time, it became very common in England to have these long dinners where you drank to the health of whoever. It could be the queen or the king, or it could be the lady of the evening, with the kind of the belle of the ball. And people began to call whoever was the belle of the ball the toast of the evening, because she flavored the party like the toast flavored the wine. So they called her the toast. And people then began to use the verb toast to describe this idea of drinking someone's health.
And then we wind up with the toast of the town.
Yes, exactly.
When you talked about dipping the toast into the wine, you also use the word soup. Well, when you dip something into a liquid, you're sopping it up. Are those words related?
Absolutely. So actually the original meaning, the original word was not soup, but sops. The word soup comes from the fact that early stews were served over toasted bread, and toasted bread soaked in liquid is a sop. So originally we had sops, and people ate sops. They ate their pottages, that's these medieval stews, with sops. And then the idea of eating sops and the dish with the sops in it was called soup. And then the idea that a meal where you mostly ate a light food like sops, that was called supper. That was the light meal.
So supper comes out of that as well.
Yeah, supper and soup are both, you know, named after, you know, dunked soppy bread.
Is there just a coincidence that the word flour, spelled F-L-O-U-R, is pronounced the same as F-L-O-W-E-R?
No, that's another one that they're in fact related. So you know, remember the Normans come over from France in 1066, and they bring all this French into English before the French came. You know, English is Anglo-Saxon; it's just Germanic.
So we have cow, and then the French bring beef, and we have pork, a pig, and the French bring pork.
Absolutely. So there's all these great French words for the foods where we still use the Anglo-Saxon words for the name of the animal. And this traditional story about why this is that you have these upper class, you know, the lords were French speaking, and so they talked about what they were eating, whereas the people actually raising the animals, you know, they were talking about the animals, and it was the Anglo-Saxon serfs. And that may very well be true, although it's also true that in some languages, it's very common to have a different word for the food you eat and for the animal. So Spanish has two words, pez and pescado. One means the fish you eat, and one means the fish in the ocean. So it's a kind of a common difference.
Back to the flour.
Back to flour, yes. We got distracted, sorry. Flour. So the original word to describe the beautiful thing on the end of a plant was blossom. That's our original Anglo-Saxon word. And this word flower comes over with the Normans, and that's the word in French, fleur, for blossom of a plant. And very quickly, even as it arrived, it already meant not just flower, but the best of something. So you have these old expressions like the flower of chivalry or the flower of knighthood. So as soon as the word was borrowed, it had this idea that it meant the best of something. And people began to say the flower of wheat. And the flower of wheat meant the best part of the wheat. And what they meant by the best part of wheat was the white part, the carbohydrate part, the endosperm, technically. So they got rid of the bran, and they got rid of the germ. And so really it's the unhealthy white flour that they called the best part, because, of course, only the rich could afford just white flour. So this idea that, you know, we're really kind of addicted to processed foods, it's actually there right in the name of the word. We still call white flour the best of, because it's taken out all of the healthy stuff.
As I assume that fleur de sel is the best of salt.
Exactly.
My guest is Dan Jarofsky, professor of linguistics and computer science at Stanford University. His book, The Language of Food, A Linguist Reads the Menu, is published by Norton. And we will return to this conversation after we take a little break. Our phone number, if you want to join in the conversation, is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And we are back with today's Please Explain, talking to Dan Jarofsky, whose book, The Language of Food, A Linguist Reads the Menu, is published by Norton. And we are inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where handle is at Leonard Lopate. Let's take a couple of those calls. Hillary from Princeton, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. Yes, thanks for taking my call. I just have a quick, funny little question about bitters. My husband loves them in gin and tonics, and we don't hear much about bitters, and I know it's a bark from a certain tree, and I guess it sounds better than asking for a little bark in your gin. So if your listener has any thoughts about bitters...
Bitters. Well, bitters are really anything in which, you know, bitters are traditionally used as a digestive, because the idea was that bitter things would help you digest. So you'd have sweet things at the end of the meal, and then you'd have a little bitter thing afterwards. And I'm not a chemist, so I don't know what the different kinds of things that can make that make things bitter. But I assume there's lots of different ingredients that have that bitter taste. The idea that bitter thing, that, you know, that sweet thing should be at the end and that bitter thing should be at the end, this idea of what belongs at the end of the meal, that's another very interesting question. So, for example, the idea that sweet things should come at the end is actually kind of a new concept in European food. We didn't have this idea that sweet things should be at the end or bitter things after that until very recently. So in the Middle Ages, you know, you could have sweet things in the middle of the meal. So really it wasn't until maybe the 1800s that, for example, we got the word dessert from French because they had this idea of putting sweet things at the end, and they got it from the Spanish, who got it from the Moors, who got it all the way back to the Persians. And if you read Herodotus, the Greek philosopher, he says, 500 BC, he says, oh, the Persians, they are obsessed with dessert. They have all these different desserts, and they mock the Greeks because the Greeks, you know, weren't so big on desserts. So this idea that certain kinds of foods, like sweet or bitter, are helpful in digestion is really very old and was invented in certain cultures, and it's still around.
And you point out that there was traditionally no exact Chinese word for dessert. The Chinese meal traditionally ended in a different way, didn't it?
Absolutely. This idea of a sweet thing. So Chinese have sweet foods. Every culture has sweet foods. But the Chinese foods, you know, this, for example, in dim sum, there are some sweet foods and there are various kinds of sweet pastries and things. But they're eaten with tea or as a separate kind of meal. The idea of a dessert at the end is just not a Chinese concept. You know, in China, you wouldn't get a sweet thing at the end. And
you wouldn't get a fortune cookie.
Yeah, you don't get a fortune cookie in China. In fact, the fact that we have fortune cookies is related to this idea. Americans expect a sweet thing at the end. It's part of what I call our grammar of cuisine. It's the rules by which, implicit rules, that we grow up, you know, expecting food to be a certain way. And so Chinese food didn't have a dessert. And so this fortune cookie was really a Japanese cookie that got co-opted in California by Chinese restaurants as a way of satisfying all these customers who kept asking for dessert.
JM left this question on our show page while you were talking about sop and soup. You mentioned in passing what sounded to him like pottage. Are sop and pottage connected?
Right. Pottage is just the name of this kind of medieval kind of vegetable soup. It's also related to the word porridge in some confusing way we don't really understand. Sops, the word isn't related. Sop isn't related as a word to pottage, but sops are what you ate with pottage. So you would have this medieval vegetable. You know, remember, you're cooking over open fires. You know, a lot of meals in those days are one-pot meals. You know, the idea of having lots of burners and different pots, really, that's a very modern concept. Even in the 19th century, right, people are cooking over a single burner or a single fire. So pottage is one of these kind of classic one pot meals. And how would you serve it? You'd pour it over these hot toasts as a way of adding some crispiness or something.
Now, turkey's an interesting name, the bird, because it's native to North America. So how did it come to be identified with turkey, which is...
That's a great one. So, in fact, the turkey, the domestic turkey that we eat, it's not even the same as the North American wild turkey. The domestic turkey is actually the Mexican variety, domesticated in Mexico maybe in the, you know, sometime, you know, thousands of years ago. And the reason why we confuse the American bird with the country turkey, I'd say it's actually caused by the fanatic secrecy of the Portuguese government in the 15th and 16th centuries. So here's the story. So you're in the 1500s, and where's the World Emporium for Spices? It's in Kerala, India. And so they're selling the black pepper and the spices originally to Ottoman Venetian traders. And then the Portuguese, trying to break this monopoly, they figure out how to go all the way around Africa. So they get to Kerala by sea, and they start selling all of these spices. And at the same time, the Europeans have colonized the New World. So the Portuguese have colonies in Brazil, and they're trading with the Spanish in Brazil, in South America. And at the same time, the Portuguese have established gold mines in West Africa. So they're bringing gold and spices and this American bird that we now call the turkey, and they're bringing the other birds. Actually, there's another bird that they brought from Africa, which was originally called the turkey cock, and it was called the turkey cock because it was imported from Africa, from Ethiopia, through Egypt, which was then run by the Ottomans, into Europe. So this bird, we now call it the guinea fowl. So So they're importing this guinea fowl and the turkey into Europe. And so Antwerp, in the northern Europe center of trade, is Antwerp. And the Portuguese had this rule that no ship's captain could publish maps or give out any kind of trade routes or explain where any of the Portuguese colonies were. They were trying to protect their colonies. So nobody really knew that some of these birds came from Africa and some of the birds came from America. And it turns out that a guinea fowl looks a lot like a small female turkey. They're both black birds with white spots. And so they're completely confused. And so this turkey name kind of got attached to the American bird, the turkey. And so everybody got confused. Shakespeare was confused. So people confused the turkey and the guinea fowl for 100 years. And finally, they kind of got them straight. And the word turkey kind of got attached to the wrong bird. And so the British had turkey. And so by 1580 or 1590, turkeys had spread throughout Europe, and it was the common bird that the English ate at harvest festivals and Christmas. So when they brought turkeys, you know, the pilgrims came to the New World, they brought the turkeys with them, and they were kind of surprised to find that there were turkeys there already.
Let's take another call. Linda from Mount Kisco. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, yes. I am wondering how the word sweetbreads got its name, the food sweetbreads.
Oh, that is a great question.
that's not in your book.
No. I don't know that.
But I think I don't know why it's sweetbread. I mean, I know why they changed the name, because sweetbreads, if we heard the real name of the sweetbread, people probably wouldn't order them. But there's nothing sweet about sweetbreads.
Right, exactly. It's raisin at pancreas. It's an organ, right?
Yes.
I don't know. Presumably with some very clever marketer. I mean, there's been marketing for a very long time. But I agree with you, Leonard, that this is just a brilliant piece of marketing.
Ezra from Manhattan, hi, you're on there.
Hey, big fan of the show. I just had a quick question about if there were any food names that were onomatopoeia-like in nature, whether it's, you know, pop if you're living in western Pennsylvania, soda, or maybe you're walking through a gourd field and you step on a squash. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Foods like that.
Nice,
that
I like both of them.
Like their name.
There is. There's actually a really subtle kind of onomatopoeia going on. And to explain it, I have to explain about vowels. So it turns out vowels across the world fall into two kinds of vowels. They're called front vowels and back vowels. So the vowel I or E, those are called front vowels because your tongue is sort of in the front of the mouth when you make them. And the vowels A, A, O, U, you can kind of feel how round they are. Those are made in the back of the mouth. The tongue is in the back. And it turns out that across almost all languages, words for small things use front vowels. So think about English. You have little and itsy bitsy and teeny tiny. They're thin, crispy. They're all I vowels. And words for large things like huge and humongous and enormous, they all have ahs and ohs and ahs. And the idea is that these front vowels are kind of a little more high frequency, and the back vowels, these ahs and ohs, are low frequency. And little animals like birds, they make little high frequency, you know, tweets. And big animals like lions, they make these big, deep, low frequency roars. So there's something about is that sounds small to us. So it turns out that cracker names use a lot of is. So if you think about cracker brands, Ritz, Wheat Thins, Triscuit, Crispy, Cheez-Its, it's all is and e's. And ice creams, you know, you want crackers to be light and thin and small, so it's natural that you would use these front vowels. Ice creams, you want them to be big and rich and kind of solid and plump, and sure enough, they use a lot of ah vowels, so, you know, Haagen-Dazs and Rocky Road and Jamocha Almond Fudge, chocolate, cookie dough, coconut, all ahs and ohs.
Now, what about macaroons, French macarons, and macaroni, which is all three are quite different from each other.
Yes,
are they related?
Yes, it's the same word. It's the same word. So, yeah, the word appears in the 13th century, macaroni. It appears in Sicily, and it seems to have very quickly meant, maybe at the very beginning, meant two similar doughy foods. So, originally, the very early recipes for the pasta, it's kind of like a gnocchi. It's not like the modern tubular macaroni. It really meant some kind of lump of flour, and it was, you know, like many things, it had medieval Arab origins. So it had rose water in it. It often had sugar in it. So it was this kind of sweet, rose watery gnocchi. And the other version of it was another kind of lumpy, doughy thing, but instead of made out of flour with cheese, it was made out of almond paste. So that's the early macaroon, which is really more like a marzipan at the time. It was a lump of almond paste with rose water again and sugar and egg whites. So these two, lots of foods in those days had a dairy version and a version made with almond paste or almond milk.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Yeah, this is because the rules of Lent in those days, the fasting rules of the Christian Church in those days, were much more strict than they are now. So you had these lean days, meaning no meat and no milk. Went every Wednesday, every Friday, all of Lent, no one's eating milk, and so it was very strict in the early days, and so you're replacing this milk with almond milk. So there are lots of dishes that had both an almond milk version and a cheese version. So one of them is what we now call calzone, the Italian, you know, cheese stuffed pizzas. There was a cheese version called the original version food was called calzone, and there was a cheese version, and then there was an almond version, and the almond version still exists. There's a French pastry called calzone. So the macaroon, the same thing. There was this cheesy macaroni, and then there was this kind of almond paste version that seems to have appeared first in France, maybe 100 years, 200 years later, called macaron.
And then we have a song, Yankee Doodle, with the song Stuck a Feather in His Hat, called it Macaroni.
Yeah, and so we think now of you know, pasta as this very everyday thing, but in the 18th century, pasta was this very exotic Italian food. English people did not eat pasta. Americans did not eat pasta. So macaroni was the name for the hipsters of the day. They were these young, rich, Englishmen who would go onto the continent, and they acquired this taste for this weird foreign food, pasta, and they called them macaronis. So the idea of like dressing fancy and being a hipster was to be a macaroni. So Yankee Doodle, you know, was by pretending to dress up, you know, put the feather in his cap, he was being a macaroni.
We're pretty much out of time, but you also point out that the word pasta and pastry, even though they're not the same anymore, come out of the same derivation. There are links between salt, salsa, sauce, and salad?
Absolutely. They all come from the word salt. Salad, salsa, sauce, also slaw, salami, and even soused. They just mean salted. They all mean the exact same thing. That's how we used to preserve food.
So all of these words, if somebody saw them initially, they would have understood that there was salt in the dish, whatever it was, salsa, sauce, salad.
Yeah, those really, the original sauce and salsa is just the word, the same word as sauce. You know, we have U in the word sauce because French, some of the L's turned into U's. But really, salsa and sauce are the same word. It really just meant the salty stuff that you added to give things flavor. And salad comes from the word erba salata, salted herbs, salted greens. So it's just another way to add to preserve the greens or add some flavoring.
Dan Jurafsky, Jurafsky, is a professor of linguistics and computer science at Stanford University. And his book is The Language of Food, A Linguist Reads the Menu. It's from Norton. Thank you so much for being on today's Please Explain.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Leonard. It's been a pleasure.